Now, welcome to my Mises Academy course on Understanding Monetary Chaos. Tonight, our topic will be Beware of False Gold Standards. Before we start, I want to answer a question that was posed to me via email by a member of the class, and that is, what is the difference between a depression and a recession? Well, one which is more or less not a serious response to that, but funny nonetheless, is a recession is when your neighbor is unemployed, and a depression is when you yourself are unemployed. But to answer it more seriously, we talk about a recession. There is a rule of thumb in today's economic literature, and that is that whenever there's two successive quarters, three-month periods, that in which GDP, or total output in the economy, declines, that is considered a recession. There is no formal definition of depression, however. So they, rather, in fact, you know, they shy away from the word depression. Milton Friedman wrote a very famous article after World War II, claiming that the U.S. economy is now depression-proof. But no one uses that term, so for example, the period that followed the financial crisis in 2008 was known as the Great Recession. And in the 1990s, the slowdown in Japanese economic growth was also referred to as the Great Recession. No one dared use the word depression for fear that it would bring back memories of the 1930s. And, you know, this is just the usual way in which euphemisms come into being. In fact, depression did not used to be the scary term. Initially, in U.S. history, downturns in business were called panics. They were usually set off by some sort of financial panic. So you have the panic of 1819. Later on, they were called crises because people began to get worried when the term panic was used. So the term crises replaced the term panic. And so you have the panic of, you know, 1857. Later on, or rather the crisis of 1857, later on, that word was considered too harsh. So the word depression, that is that the business was slightly depressed, that was used. So we had the depression of 1873. We had the depression of 1920-21. But then after the Great Depression, the term recession came into widespread use, and that was in the 1950s after World War II. And if you think of recession, it means that, you know, a business is receding from its previous level. Output is receding from its previous high level, but it will return to that level. So it was considered to be a softer, more consumer-friendly term than the word depression. And then later on, the 1980s, we had a very severe, recessions in 1973 to 75. And again, we had two packed into the 3 years, 1980 to 1982. So even though a recession began to be pushed aside, and we had words like sideways waffling, the economy just going sideways, it's not really, we're not really in a recession. Or now the term soft landing is used. The economy's going down, but it's not going to go down too far. We're going to land softly. Things will be okay. But for the Austrian economist, there is no difference between a recession and a depression. I mean, you might want to use the term historically and say depression is a much deeper and longer version of a recession. But fundamentally, they're caused by the same thing for the Austrian, which is to say that they're caused by inflation of the money supply that distorts interest rates and distorts the whole structure of production, causes an increase in this, in the investment in capital goods, or I should say malinvestments in capital goods, bad investments in capital goods, and also at the same time an overconsumption. People feel wealthier than they really are because of the low interest rates and the fact that they're, for example, the prices of their houses are rising and the value of their 401k has gone up. So they're induced by that seeming increase in financial wealth to spend more on consumer goods. In any case, those characteristics mark both a recession and a depression. So I would say ultimately, speaking technically, there isn't really no difference between a recession and a depression or a panic or crisis. They're caused by an inflationary boom that is usually engineered by banks, fractional reserve banks, or in the era of central banks by the central bank increasing fractional reserve bank reserves. So let's move on now to talking about gold standards. Gold standards that are true or genuine and false or pseudo gold standards. So let's go to our first slide here. What we're going to do, if you notice, is the spectrum of monetary systems in front of you there. And it goes from the best on the left to the worst form of the system on the right. And I'm not too interested in the systems that are not in bold. So we're going to talk about the classical gold standard, which isn't the perfect gold standard, which is all the way on the left, the 100% gold standard. I'll only say a few words about that. Basically, money comes into existence as a pure commodity. So initially, you always have a 100% commodity standard, or as I call it, their market supply commodity money. Classical gold standard arises when you have some government intervention into the economy, possibly a central bank or a number of privileged banks, such as under the national banking system in the United States from 1865 through the formation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. Though gold is still money, gold still restrains the privileged banks or the central bank from inflating the money supply or expanding the money supply to any great degree. We then move to the right, and you see there a number of different types of monetary systems, fluctuating exchange rates, in which different governments and central banks produce different national currencies, and they vary in value against one another. We have something like that right now. It's called dirty floating or managed floating, where exchange rates change, but governments put limits on how much they can change. So it's called dirty floating because the government interferes with the market forces that would determine the real values in terms of one another of those national fiat currencies. But I want to concentrate tonight on the classical gold standard. And if you look to the right on the fixed exchange rates, the so-called false gold standards, which existed from 1925 to 31, that was known as the gold exchange standard. And more recently and more prominently, what was called the Bretton Woods system from 1946 until its collapse in 1971. And then I'll talk a little bit about a new proposal for what I would consider to be a pseudo gold standard or a phony gold standard that was introduced into Congress as a bill last year. And so we'll talk about that. So moving on. What are the main characteristics of the gold standard? You can see them there listed before you. Money is, or the monetary unit, is legally defined as a particular weight of gold. It may have a different name. It may have the name of a dollar, which was defined for 100 years, from 1834 to 1933, as about 1/20th of an ounce of gold, but I'll get to that. For example, a British pound, which was defined as a 1/4 of an ounce of gold, or a French franc, which was defined as 1/100th of an ounce of gold. Okay. But under that system, gold is money. Okay. Gold is the money, or the basic money of the system. Anything else, any banknotes or deposits, as we'll see, are, under gold standard, instantaneously redeemable in gold. Okay. They are claims to gold. Okay. They're not gold itself. They become what we call money substitutes, okay? And so you have, but you do have gold coins are in circulation along with these money substitutes, that is deposits and banknotes. So money, Mises made the distinction between money in the narrow sense, which was just the basic commodity that was money, such as gold, and money in the broader sense, which includes not only the gold coin, and gold bullion, the gold bar, but also, for example, the banknotes and bank deposits. So they are part of the money supply in the broader sense. But fundamentally, they are claims to gold. Okay, they're not gold itself, but they're not money themselves, but they function as money. As long as people believe that they will be redeemed in the form of the ultimate money in the system, which is gold. And as I mentioned before, central banks may or may not exist in this system. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the monetary unit. Under the gold standard, as I said, the currency name is simply the name for a particular weight of gold. You can look there in front of you and notice that for 100 years, from 1834 to 1933, gold in the U.S. was legally defined as approximately 23.22 grains of gold, which works out to be about or approximately 1/20 of an ounce of gold. The British pound from 1821 to 1931 was legally defined as 1/4 of an ounce of gold or 113 grains of gold. French franc is 1/100 of an ounce of gold, and so on. Okay, it didn't mean that these nations had different currencies, just because the names of their currency units were different. In fact, they were all on the gold standard. Okay, gold was the money. Okay, they had different units, that's all. The names just refer to the different units, and they were legally defined, these names were legally defined as weight of gold. So if you were to travel from the United States to Great Britain or France or Germany, Germany came late to the gold standard after the 1870s, it was on a silver standard for a long time. But in any case, you could take American gold coins and they would be accepted in Great Britain or France. What was important was the weight. Okay, so they would simply look at they believe that the weight was as denominated as was stamped. It would be accepted in the same way that coins that were minted in Great Britain would be accepted or France. In fact, in the early Republic, in the late 1700s, the U.S. dollar, there was no U.S. dollar. I mean, it wasn't minted. There was no money minted in the U.S. The dollar was simply a Mexican dollar that was minted in Mexico City. It was a silver dollar, and it circulated in the U.S. So how do we get that money? Well, simply when people want money, they sell goods. So you export more goods than you import. So you're selling more to the rest of the world, and they have to pay you in money. So we had an inflow of silver, and that's how our money was supplied before the U.S. began minting its own dollars. And then there another point that you should keep in mind that the gold standard does not mean fixed exchange rates. For example, for about 100 years, as I mentioned, the exchange rate between in quotation marks, exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and the British pound was, as you can see there, $4.86 per pound, plus or minus 1%. In any case, why was that the case? Why was it stable for so long? Well, because really it was just the law of arithmetic. There was five times the amount, approximately, of gold in a British pound as there was in the dollar. So to get a British pound, you had to give up around $5, $4.86 to be precise. And as you see from my example down there, the exchange rate between dollars and pounds was no different than what you might call an exchange rate between nickels and quarters, right? It just really follows from the law of arithmetic. A nickel is defined as 1/20 of a dollar. A quarter is defined as 1/4 of a dollar. So therefore, if you divide a quarter by a nickel, that is 1/4 by 1/20, you get 5 nickels equals 1/4, an exchange rate between nickels and quarters. It's the same money, okay? They're all different names for units of the dollar, just as the pound and the dollar were different names for units of weight of gold. So don't fall for the idea that for some reason the gold standard is a fixed exchange rate system. Okay, there aren't any exchange rates. They're simply different weights of gold. Okay, so just to give you an example, here we have a $20 gold coin from 1921 exhibited at the top, and a $5 gold coin from 1906 exhibited at the bottom. This was the ultimate cash of the system. These coins circulated, they were routinely accepted. And so under a genuine gold standard, under the classical gold standard that we had in the 19th century, gold coin did circulate, okay? It began to fall out of circulation after World War I, in the 1920s. In fact, there was a campaign against people using gold coins. It was often said that if you use a gold coin, you were old-fashioned. In fact, people should use checks and paper dollars. They're more convenient, more secure against being burglarized or robbed and so on. But here's something interesting. The gold was the money, and the money substitute was the banknote. For example, take this banknote here. If you look at it, okay, this is before we had a Federal Reserve. This banknote was issued in 1903 by the Farmers and Merchants National Bank of Los Angeles. Okay, and notice what it says right under Los Angeles. It says, "We'll pay to the bearer on demand $20. In other words, it doesn't say this note is $20. It says we'll pay to the bearer on demand $20. And everybody knew what that meant. They didn't even have to say gold dollars, because gold was money. Okay, gold, the dollar was defined as the weight of gold. So if you said I'll pay you $20, that means I'll pay you a full ounce of gold. Okay, so the note was not money itself, it was merely a promise to pay. Dollars. It wasn't $20 itself, but promised to pay $20, okay, which was the goal. Now, it circulated as a dollar precisely because people were confident, to the extent that they were confident that they could get their gold in exchange for this note at the issuing institution. Okay, once that confidence was shaken, then that note no longer was a claim to gold, or it was only a very iffy claim to gold. So its value would fall below $20. It might circulate at $10, because there was a risk that it would not be repaid, that the bank was shaky. Okay, or it may lose all of its value. It only had value to the extent that people believed that it would be paid on demand at par value, at the full face value in dollars. So to go on, here's just a claim for $5 issued by the First National Bank of Fort Myers. Again, we'll pay the bearer on demand. This is in 1908. $5. Again, it doesn't say we'll pay $5 in gold. Okay, dollars were defined as gold. So what about the principles of operation of the gold standard? How did it operate? Okay, as I mentioned before, it did not involve fixed exchange rates. Or as monetarists who criticize the gold standard often say, it involves the government fixing the price of gold, okay? That is, the government intervening in the gold market and making sure the price of gold was $20 per ounce by buying and selling gold at $20. But as we saw in the previous two slides, these paper dollars were not money in and of themselves. They were just claims, okay? So when the bank paid out the gold for the dollars, it wasn't selling gold for dollars, okay? All it was doing was returning people's property for this claim. Just as when you go to if you leave your clothes at a dry cleaning establishment to get them cleaned, when you come in with a ticket, the ticket doesn't have value, or any value that ticket has is based on the value of the clothing that you get in return. Or if you sell your car and you have an ownership title and the car is not presently in your possession, let's say it's in another state, but you can sell it anyway, you turn over the title of ownership and sign it over to the individual for, let's say, $10,000, the buyer. Obviously, he doesn't think that title to ownership has value in and of itself. It only has value to the extent that he can get the car in exchange for it. Immediately upon presenting it. Okay, so turning over an ounce of gold for banknotes or bank deposits is simply returning someone's property. Okay, so filling a contract to redeem someone's property for a claim, much as a dry cleaning establishment does today or a warehouse does today if you store your furniture, or a storage unit does today if you store your possessions in a storage unit. Okay, the second point I want to make about the gold standard and it has to do with what's called the balance of payments adjustment mechanism. And there was a fancy name for this coined in the 19th century called the price specie flow mechanism. Specie is another name for precious metals like gold and silver. So it was referred to the flow of gold or silver that resulted from a difference in prices in different parts of the world or in different regions of the same country. So what did this mechanism tend to do, or what did it do? It maintained equilibrium in the balance of payments, made sure that countries didn't have ongoing deficits or ongoing surpluses in their balance of payments, that over time, balances of payments were in equilibrium, that is, they balanced. Exports and imports basically balanced when you counted lending and borrowing across nations. And it also, more importantly, limited the increase in the money supply, and we've been using MS for money supply, so that should be an increase in MS. Okay, so it limited the increase in money supply, I'll show you how in a moment, and therefore it limited inflation, okay, by central banks or just simply by fractional reserve banks acting on their own. In the long run, under the gold standard, the money supply is limited by gold mining. Okay, so banknotes, in the long run, banknotes and deposits can only increase to the extent that new gold flows into the system. Okay, so there was gold mining in South Africa, there was gold mining in California, eventually in Alaska, and other parts of the world. So when new gold was discovered, Australia also, by the way, let's say new gold was discovered as it was in Australia in the 1870s. What happened and what some economists noticed was that prices went up in Australia first. As prices went up in Australia, the value of gold in Australia fell. Gold could buy less in Australia because prices were rising. So then people would look to other countries to purchase goods where prices were lower, and so therefore they would buy from Europe, they would buy from the U.S., they would buy from parts of Asia. So gold would flow out of Australia, where it was mined, and into other countries. So prices were kept in equilibrium throughout the world economy over time. Okay, and the balance of payments. So Australia would have, for as long as it was mining gold and its money supply was increasing, it would have a balance of payments deficit, and it would exchange some of this new gold for imported products. But eventually, prices elsewhere would rise, and if gold mining did not continue at a very rapid pace, then eventually gold would stop flowing out of Australia. Okay, so since gold mining or gold was mined at a rate that wasn't very rapid, except during years when new gold was discovered in certain areas, what you had was a tendency for prices to fall, okay, throughout the world economy, because goods and services were growing at a faster rate than the supply of money. And as a result, supplies of goods and services were increasing, putting downward pressure on prices. Some of this downward pressure was offset by the increase in the money supply due to the increase in gold. But as I said, the increase in the supply of goods and services far outweighed the increase in the price of gold. So as I mentioned last week, you had a fall in prices under the classical gold standard. So there's the price specie flow mechanism and symbols. I had something up last week that was very similar. And let's see how it restrains inflation. So let's start with, let me find my pointer here. We'll start with increase the money supply. Okay, so you have an increase in the money supply. Let's say that the central bank increases bank reserves, okay, that is, it prints more notes. That's how it would increase bank reserves in the old days. Let's say the Bank of England prints more Bank of England notes and either loans them to the banks or loans them to government who spends them and they get back into the bank, then the money supply will increase as the bank loan the new reserves out. That, we're talking about the U.S., so that will push up prices in the United States. And notice prices will now be higher than world prices. Okay, so it will be more expensive to buy goods in the U.S., both for U.S. residents and for residents of foreign countries. So that would cause U.S. exports to fall because they're more expensive, but U.S. imports increase because U.S. Citizens now find that their own domestically produced products have a higher price, so they begin buying from Great Britain, Germany, Australia, and so on. And once you have imports exceeding exports, the only way to pay for those excess imports is to you get a balance payment deficit. So the only way to pay for that deficit is to pay in money. Now, foreigners do not want U.S. dollars. They don't use dollars, paper dollars in Great Britain or Australia. Okay, they will, however, take our gold, since that's, they're on the gold standard. That's money there. This is money here. So gold will flow out of the U.S. That's very important. Once that begins to happen, people who have money in banks in the U.S. begin to worry. Okay, they see gold flowing out of bank reserves. There's a fear, loss of confidence, let's say, occurs, and banks are very aware of this. So they don't want what's called an internal drain. Okay, so price is rising, you have an external drain. You have gold flowing out of the country to other countries. But to the extent that gold reserves are decreasing and people begin to get worried about that movement, there could also be an internal drain into the country. People rush to the banks, turn in those bank notes that I showed you earlier, and bank deposits, and in exchange for gold. But since the banks are fractional reserve institutions, they can't pay off all their depositors and note holders. So what they're going to have to do then is to reduce the money supply. Okay? They begin to lend less. That reduces the amount of notes and deposits, and that pushes U.S. prices down again below world prices. So you get a reverse movement. U.S. now becomes less expensive, less gold in the country, and less the money supply has fallen, so prices have fallen, and you get people wanting to buy more goods from the U.S., both American citizens and foreign nationals. So foreigners buy more of our exports, American citizens buy more domestic products, and therefore they reduce the amount of imports, and you finally get a balance of payment surplus, and the gold flows back into the U.S. until the money supply increases to its natural level, the level at which we started before the inflation, and prices are equilibrated, are equalized throughout the world economy. So it is true that under a classical gold standard, where you have fractional reserve banking, or you even have a central bank, the banks could temporarily cause increases in the money supply, and they could cause an inflationary boom, and they did, which would result in a recession. But these do not last very long because of this price specie flow mechanism that forces banks to reduce the money supply again. Okay. Now here's the classic money pyramid under the classical gold standard. So this will give you an idea of what I'm just talking about in the form of a simple illustration or picture. Okay, so let's start at the bottom. So at the very bottom, let's say that the central bank, has holds all the gold reserves. And so it has $2 billion in gold reserves. And let's say its reserve ratio is 40%. That is, the central bank can issue its own notes, but it can only do so while keeping 40% of those notes in reserve as gold. So let's say it creates, so forget the red numerals for a moment, let's look at the black. So if it has $2 billion in gold, that means it can create central bank notes up to $5 billion, okay? Because two over 5 is 40%. So now there's 2.5 times the amount of central bank notes in existence as compared to gold. So each note is 40% backed by gold. Okay, then what happens when those notes get in circulation, people deposit them in the banks. And let's assume the banks keep a reserve rate of 20%. So as they get these central bank notes, they can pyramid on those notes five of their own particular dollars. Okay, the notes I showed you before from the bank in Los Angeles and the bank in Fort Myers, Florida. So what they're able to do then is to hold 20% of their deposits and notes, so they can increase deposits and notes to the extent of $25 billion. So they have $25 billion outstanding throughout the country in private bank notes and deposits, and backing that up is 20% of central bank notes. So notice what you have. You have a money supply of $25 billion in the economy, okay, of commercial bank notes and deposits, but they're all backed by $2 billion of gold. So that's why we have the inverted pyramid. Okay, again, just look at the black lines and black numerals. Don't worry about the blue line or the red numeral. Okay. So at that point, let's say there's equilibrium in the world economy. U.S. prices are no higher or no lower than elsewhere. So money's not flowing in or out of the country. But now let's say that the central bank wants to expand the money supply, increase its own notes by 20%. So it goes from $5 billion and it goes up to $6 billion. So it increases a billion more dollars. Okay, it adds $1 billion more in notes. Okay. That means now that the commercial banks now have, instead of $5 billion, they have $6 billion. And they can loan those out and they can pyramid $5 billion more of their own notes and deposits on the central bank reserves. So notice the money supply in the U.S. increases from $25 billion to $30 billion over here. That's about a 20% increase. So let's say prices increase by 20% in the U.S. as people rush out and spend $5 billion new dollars. What's interesting is, and what's going to happen, is that prices rise. The U.S. becomes the worst market to sell in. So our imports, our exports go down. Okay, it becomes a worse market to buy from if the price is 20% more. So our exports fall, but on the other hand, it's a better market to sell in. When prices are higher, you want to sell there. So more imports flow into the country, and we have a balance of payments deficit. Now I didn't show this on this particular slide, but what would happen is that let's say we have a balance of payments deficit of $1 billion. Remember, foreigners don't want our private bank notes and deposits. They want gold. So what would happen is if the $1 billion deficit, suddenly the people that are importing goods from foreigners have to turn in their notes and deposits and demand gold. And the banks are going to have to go to the central bank, turn in some of their central bank notes, their reserves, and get gold. So now suddenly the $2 billion of gold reserves in the U.S. is cut in half to $1 billion. As $1 billion is sent overseas to pay for the deficit. And that then makes this pyramid, okay, become much more unstable. Notice that suddenly you have a wider part at the top. And if you follow this line all the way down, which I did, but I corrected this, but I forgot to put it up. If you follow this all the way down to about here, you'll notice that while it's getting wider at the top, there's now only half the amount of gold supporting more dollars. There's $30 billion in circulation. Now only $1 billion in gold. And so the reserve ratio has fallen tremendously. And people start to get nervous. There's a threat of bank runs. And the loss of gold reserves to foreigners could be compounded by a loss of gold reserves to depositors and note holders who turn in their note deposits for gold. And the gold reserves could disappear out of the whole banking system. So what happens is that the central bank then reduces the amount of notes when they're paid back, since they've loaned them out. They don't reissue them. And so the bank reserves fall to $5 billion. And at the same reserve, reserve ratio, suddenly now the commercial banks reduce the amount of loans and deposits and notes they've issued. And so you have a decrease back to a level at which U.S. prices fall back to equality with world prices. And that's how the gold standard, even though, by the way, when the money supply is deflated like that, when it decreases like that, there is recession. So you do have a recession, but it happens very quickly. Okay, the inflation doesn't get too out of control. It's reversed very quickly by the price species flow mechanism. This theory was first put forth by a British economist, which we talked about, whom we talked about last week, the currency school, and it was sort of the seeds of the Austrian business cycle theory, that the inflation causes a boom, causes seeming prosperity, but then later results in a recession. Okay, but on the classic gold standard, you don't get a deep recession, just as you don't get a very great inflation. Okay, unless you go off the gold standard, as was the case during wartime in Great Britain and the U.S. and other countries, then you can just print paper money and not worry about reserves. Okay, so the classical gold standard worked very well in restraining inflation and not allowing very, very deep recessions. But everyone went off in 1914. The various belligerents in World War I, both sides, the Allies and the Axis nations, Germany, Austria, Hungary, and initially Italy, they all went off the gold standard. The U.S. didn't get involved until 1917, but the U.S. and France, Great Britain and France, went off the gold standard again within 2 weeks of the start of the war, because the war was enormously expensive, and to try to pay for a war through taxes would cause a tax revolt among the population. So all governments attempt to hide the cost of the war by printing money up, okay, and getting the resources they need through what's called inflationary finance. That way, people don't see the money coming directly out of their pockets. They suddenly see prices going up, and then they begin to complain about people that are war profiteers that are gouging them through higher prices. And of course, the government encourages this and then puts price controls on during the war. So getting to the U.S., we began to go off the classical gold standard during that World War I. The Fed started, there were certain regulations passed that caused gold to be centralized at the Fed rather than being held individually by banks themselves. There was a heavy tax placed on private issue of banknotes, and so it reduced the number of banks that privately issued their own notes. Eventually, it was outlawed completely in 1920, that is, the private issue of notes. Also, at least during World War I, U.S. citizens were not permitted to export gold abroad, so that short-circuited the price specie flow mechanism. Also, the Fed cut reserve requirements in half, meaning that banks could loan out more of the reserves that they already had. So the money supply doubled from 1913 to 1919. So we had a huge inflation in the U.S. And you see there, the Fed cut average reserve requirements. Banks before had to hold around 20% of their deposits and notes in the form of gold. Now, when the Fed came into existence and began to cut reserve requirements, that was cut to about 10% or so. So that helped add to the inflation. And then the Fed deliberately inflated during the 1920s, not only to keep prices from falling, but also to help keep prices up in the U.S. so that it was easier for Great Britain to go back to the gold standard at their old, what's called parity exchange rate. Okay. British prices were very, very high, so they were losing gold. Okay. If they had gone back at the old value of their currency, their prices would have been too high, and they would have lost a lot of gold, so the U.S. wants to help them get back on the gold standard, and so it kept U.S. prices up by inflating the money supply. And then we had the Great Depression struck. Great Britain went off the gold standard in 1931. It made the pound a fiat currency. The U.S. did so in 1933 after a lot of bank runs. It was done by an executive order from FDR. On May 1st. And also, not only were citizens forced to turn in all their gold to banks and to the Treasury in exchange for paper Fed notes, but they were also not allowed to own gold okay, and that was repealed in 1976, I believe, that prohibition on ownership of gold. Dentists and jewelers, if they were licensed, were permitted to own gold to use for the purposes of their business, but no one else was really allowed to own gold, no U.S. citizen. It was actually prohibited. And we also devalued. Devalue mean making the dollar less valuable in terms of gold. So instead of 1/20th of an ounce of gold, at $35 an ounce, gold is now worth 1/35th of an ounce of gold. But it didn't matter because you couldn't bring $35 to the treasury to get, or to the bank to get gold, because we were no longer on the gold standard and it was illegal to even own gold. So here's the executive order. It says, under executive order of the president, and that was issued on April 5th, 1933, all persons are required to deliver on or before May 1st, 1933, all gold coin, gold bullion, and gold certificates now owned by them to a Federal Reserve Bank branch or agency or to any member bank of the Federal Reserve System. So that was the order that, and then they specified what would happen in case you violated this order, but you had to do it by May 1st. Okay. You can see at the bottom, criminal penalty for violation of executive order, $10,000 fine or 10 years imprisonment or both as provided in Section 9 of the order. Okay. So they were serious about all this. And the punishment was very rigorous, and they were determined to smash the gold standard. And they did so. Now, during the 1930s, early 1940s, every country up the gold standard, they all tried to make their currency cheaper by devaluing it in terms of other currencies. And they did that because if you made your own currency cheaper, then it made your goods cheaper in terms of other currencies, and it would make them purchase more from you and increase employment in your country. But of course, if you devalue your currency, they devalue. So they reciprocate. So all you had was a reciprocal devaluation of the currencies. Nobody really gained an advantage. You had monetary chaos in the 1930s through World War II. So during World War II, the Allies got together. They wanted a post-war world to have some monetary order, and they figured the way to, but they loved paper money, so they didn't really want to go back to a real gold standard. So they went back to a phony gold standard. At the Bretton Woods system. Okay, so they met. Great Britain and the U.S. in particular were the two countries that really led this movement and were the two most influential countries. U.S. even more than Great Britain, because the U.S. was the real victor in World War II. And so they met in 1944. They hammered out a program for a phony gold standard. Okay, so BW, the Bretton Woods system, was a false gold standard. And it tried to bring some monetary order to this chaos that reigned during the 1930s, okay? But they wanted to camouflage, to restore people's trust in the currency, to camouflage it as a gold standard. So the main architects were the U.S. and British governments, and particularly their leading advisors, okay? Harry Dexter White in the U.S., who was the Treasury official, and John Maynard Payne, who was a Treasury consultant, and I guess during World War II was a Treasury official in Great Britain. Since the U.S. was more, now both Keynes and White came up with their own plans, okay, for a gold-plated, we'll call it, a gold-plated monetary system that was really fiat money, a central bank-dominated monetary system. Harry Dexter White's plan, since he represented the U.S., which was more powerful at the time, was the one that had more of its program incorporated the Bretton Woods Agreement that came out of all this. And Harry Dexter White was a Soviet spy during that period, and before and after. We'll talk about that in a moment. But there's a book out by Benjamin Stile, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's on Bretton Woods. And this year marks the, since it was 1944, marks, I believe, the 60th or 70th anniversary of Bretton Woods. Okay. The 60th 60th anniversary of Bretton Woods is this year. And there is a picture of Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods was a very upscale resort for rich people in New Hampshire. And it still stands today. They refurbished it. I just visited this summer. It's a beautiful place. And you can see one of the highest peaks in certainly the eastern part of the country, Mount Washington, from the back of the resort itself. They have a veranda where you can eat and lounge and watch and you can see people going up using a chairlift, but I can't remember the name, but those cars that are lifted up to the peak of the mountain. So that's where they all met, including the Soviet representative, Chinese representative, and so on. Okay. Let's go to the next slide. There's Keynes on the right and Harry Dexter White on the left at Bretton Woods. And there's a room, I think, that is the room they're in. There's a room that had a plaque on it that indicates that that's where the Bretton Woods Agreement was forged and hammered out. So what about Harry Dexter White, the Soviet spy? You can see here, it was in August 1948, he was asked to testify or subpoenaed to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. He tried to defend himself, but historians agree, okay, especially with the release of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the release of secret documents, that he was passing secret state information to the Soviet Union during World War II. Benjamin Stahel, who wrote the book on Bretton Woods, I can't remember the name of it, I meant to put it in here, agrees that yes, he was a Soviet spy, but that he acted out of idealism and not as a member of the Communist Party, which he never was a member of the Communist Party. Not simply because he believed that the Soviet Union was a vital U.S. ally, but because he also believed passionately in the success of the bold Soviet experiment in socialism. And in the book, there are quotes from Harry Dexter White promoting or praising the Soviet system. And Stahel goes on to say that White was not a Communist Party member because White would not take orders from Moscow. He worked on his own terms. He joined no underground movement. But he still did pass information to the Soviets. And by the way, he died 3 days later after his testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee. He died of a heart attack 3 days later. But as I said, his achievement stood until 1971. So what about the Bretton Woods system? What can we say about it? Key characteristics was that the U.S. dollar was the only currency, it's called a fiat currency, convertible into gold. And it was convertible at the rate of $34.5 per ounce at that devalued rate. All other currencies were convertible into dollars at fixed but adjustable exchange rate. So other currencies, the pound, the franc, the German mark, they were convertible not into gold but into dollars. Okay. And they held U.S. dollars to back their own money. Okay. And by the way, dollars were only convertible into gold for foreign official institutions, that is central banks, foreign governments, and international institutions like the IMF, which came out of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, all of those institutions that came out of Bretton Woods. You and I, as U.S. citizens or grandparents, were not permitted to own any gold and could not convert their dollars into gold during the Bretton Woods system. Needless to say, there was no gold coin in circulation, there was no gold coin that was minted, okay? And as I mentioned, the non-key currencies, all the other currencies besides the dollar, were not backed by gold, they were backed by U.S. dollars. Because at the time, U.S. had most of the gold in the world, had accumulated most of the gold in the world because it was the main supplier to the Allies of war equipment and material and food and so on during World War II. And they paid for much of this with their gold. So we had most of the gold in the world. So what were its principles of operation? It was actually even more of a pyramid, okay, where you had at the bottom of the pyramid was the U.S. gold supply, and I'll give you some figures on that in a moment. But at the top of the pyramid was not just these notes and deposits, or now just bank deposits of the private commercial banks in the U.S., but the deposits of private commercial banks were actually used to back up the currency or the monies of the foreign banks of foreign governments. Okay, so they pyramided. They used U.S. bank deposits, U.S. dollars, as reserves for their own money supply. So they pyramided on top of dollars. So the inverted pyramid got even bigger and more precarious. And it had a weird balance of payments adjustment mechanism because initially, at least, these foreign official institutions were willing to accept dollars, okay, when they were when there was balance of payments deficit. They're willing to accept dollars now. They didn't demand gold because they used dollars to back up their own money supply. So what happened was when the Fed would, expand the money supply, again, similar to the classical gold standard, it would certainly be true that U.S. prices would go up above world prices, sub W. U.S. exports would go down because it would be very expensive to buy from, and U.S. imports would go up because we'd have high prices and we'd want to sell in the U.S., and U.S. citizens would want to buy these cheaper goods from abroad, and we get the balance of payments deficit. Okay, so the balance of payments would be less than zero, which means a deficit. But dollars would flow out of the country, okay? And these dollars would be used to back the foreign money supply. So MS sub F refers to the foreign money supply. As their money supplies increased, world prices would rise. Okay, so the U.S. exported through the Bretton Woods system world inflation. We called it an inflation in Europe. Okay, because again, they didn't ask us, they didn't demand their gold for our dollars. They accepted the dollars. But when their exporters earned dollars from the U.S., they went to their central banks and they sold their central banks the dollars. And to buy these dollars and keep their exchange rates fixed, the central banks had to create their own more of their own currency to buy the dollars, and that caused inflation in their country. So let's look explain a little bit more here. I'm having a little problem shifting to the next slide. Let me just here we go. Okay, let me go back. Okay. So the U.S. continued. The U.S. had no reason not to continue to increase the money supply, because and run a chronic balance of payments deficit. So if you see the first bullet point there, we continued to increase the money supply because there were no bad consequences. Dollars just flowed out, and real goods and services came into the U.S. So in effect, we were trading depreciating paper dollars in exchange for real goods and services. So U.S. living standards actually rose because of that. So it was a global surplus of dollars. And as long as foreign governments and central banks, however, were willing to buy the excess dollars, whenever those dollars went to foreign countries and exporters got them and sold them to their central bank, U.S. didn't have to worry about balance of payments deficits. That was a famous French economist who was very pro-gold standard and wanted to go back to the gold standard, the classical gold standard, and get rid of the Bretton Woods system. His name was Jacques Rueff, you see there. He said that the U.S. could run, he called it a deficit without peers. For the first time in history, a country could actually print paper money and buy up goods from other countries without ever having to pay for those goods in gold. So there was no incentive for the U.S. to stop inflating the money supply. So we exported paper dollars and inflation in the rest of the world, and what did we get in exchange? More goods, more good things that satisfied human wants. Well, they got our paper dollars, and they got inflation. But what that meant was that U.S. prices rose. One gold ounce, remember, $35, could buy foreign currency that purchased more goods than $35. In other words, as U.S. prices were higher than world prices, because we kept inflating, what you could do was you could take those U.S. dollars and you could go, if you earned them, let's say you sold goods to the U.S., you earned dollars, you could buy gold if you weren't an American citizen in London or Europe. So it would pay you to take $35, buy an ounce of gold with it, and then buy foreign currency with that ounce of gold that had more purchasing power. So you could buy these foreign currencies, buy even more goods in Europe, and then export them to the U.S. for even more than $35. So you would make a profit. That's called arbitrage. Okay? Maybe you could actually buy $40 worth of goods and services and then export them to the U.S., earn $40, go back, buy gold, and then with the gold, retail for these foreign currencies. And so what was happening was because everybody was rushing to buy gold in these free gold markets of London and Zurich and elsewhere, using dollars to buy gold, that pushed the dollar price of gold up. The only way the U.S. could keep the dollar price down to $35 an ounce instead of going up to $40 an ounce was to sell a lot of gold. But that meant that U.S. reserves of gold kept going down. So suddenly we started losing our gold during the 1950s. But we continued to do that, to inflate. We expanded the money supply in the 1960s, even as we were losing gold to foreign countries, because we wanted to pay both the Vietnam War and President Johnson's social welfare programs. So Johnson did not want to raise taxes to pay for the Vietnam War or to pay for various social welfare programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and so on. But he wanted to do it in the easiest way possible, and he wanted to avoid taxes. So it continued to be inflation in the U.S. Foreign goods flowed into the U.S. Dollars continued to flow out. So foreigners kept accepting these dollars, and in exchange, we got real goods and services. So believe it or not, during the war, which was very expensive, the U.S. citizenry, we didn't pay for the Vietnam War. Foreigners paid for the Vietnam War in the form of inflation and having fewer goods in their countries as exports were sent to the U.S. Okay. So eventually, though, after 1965, France and Germany began to demand gold for some of their dollars. They wanted to convert their dollars back into gold now. They no longer trusted the dollar because the U.S. gold stock was now falling. And they were afraid that the U.S. would eventually be unable to pay off all the dollars that they held in France and Germany and elsewere in gold. So there's an interesting story. So actually two anecdotes. One, we refused to give Germany its gold back. Germany was still an occupied country as it is even today. It had a lot of U.S. troops. We threatened Europe that if they really wanted their gold back, well, then we wouldn't be able to afford the nuclear protection against the Soviet Union. So we more or less blackmailed Germany into backing off. France didn't back off. France dropped out of NATO for a while and got their own developed their own nuclear force and to protect themselves, also sent a warship to the U.S. to collect the gold in exchange for the dollars. The U.S. was going to pay the gold off. It was going to pay the dollar liabilities that France demanded. And again, it was Jacques Rouef, who was the advisor to the French President de Gaulle, who was able, who convinced de Gaulle to do this. So they didn't send a regular, ship, freighter or something like that, because they didn't want any accidents, quote unquote, occurring as they were leaving with their gold. So they sent a warship and they got their gold back, or some of it at least. So here's what happened to the U.S. gold stock. So in 1950, we had, if you value it at $35 an ounce, we had $25 billion in gold, but foreigners only had $12 billion in U.S. dollars. So we U.S. citizens couldn't demand gold for their dollars. So to make a long story short, we had more than enough gold to pay foreigners off. That's why they were willing to accept the dollar and use it to back their own money, because they believed it was as good as gold, quote unquote. By 1967, after the Vietnam War heated up, after we had these very expensive social welfare programs put in place, foreigners got more and more dollars leaked out of the U.S. because of our balance of payments deficits. Gold reserves began to fall, so we cut in half. We had $12 billion. By 1968, we only had $10 billion, but there was $60 billion in claims on that gold. And so it was during that period that France and Germany began to worry and began to demand gold. There was a lot of pressure on foreign markets for gold. The prices were going up. The U.S. had to keep selling gold to keep these prices down. Finally, in 1968, we had a two-tier system, meaning after 1968, the U.S. was going to let the price of gold go up on free markets, on the market, but would trade gold for dollars at $35 an ounce with other banks. Finally, by 1971, we were down to $9 billion. There were $80 billion of foreign liabilities. There was a run on the U.S. gold stock, and within 2 weeks, we were lost for our gold. So that's when President Nixon closed the gold window. You had a collapse of the Bretton Woods system. And here's what Nixon announced that Sunday night when he also imposed wage and price control on the American economy. He said, "We must protect the position of the American dollar as a pillar of monetary stability around the world." He pointed out in the last 7 years, there's been an average of one international monetary crisis every year. Then he went on to say that he directed Secretary of Treasury Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in the amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and the best interests of the United States. So basically, he said it would temporarily be suspended, but that was it. That was the last link to gold. And so the gold standard was completely dead by that point. All other countries went off the gold standard. They tried to reestablish in 1973 something called the Smithsonian Agreement, where there would be no gold, but all the different currencies would have fixed exchange rates. President Nixon called that the greatest monetary agreement in the history of the world. And it collapsed 13 months later. And since then, we've had floating exchange rates, dirty floats, and all different kinds of arrangements. But no gold standard. We're almost ran out of time, but I do want to say a few things about a new proposal for a gold standard. It's called the dollar bill standard. I'll take a few minutes on this. There's been agitation to go back to gold standard on the part of a number of journalists and media commentators since the financial crisis in 2008. There was a recent proposal that called for the Fed to target the price of gold, and now serves as the basis for a congressional bill. That bill was introduced by Representative Ted Poe into Congress last year, about a year ago actually, in April, and it's called the Dollar Bill Act of 2013. Okay, what does the Dollar Bill Act tell us, or what is it about? It would legally mandate the Fed to fix the price of gold within a very narrow range. The first step would be to get the Board of Governors of the Fed to designate a date no sooner than 90 days from the passage of the bill and no later than 120 days from the enactment of the bill. Okay, during that window, the 30-day window, they would use a random process, and they would designate a target week. You know, they would randomly do this. They find the target week, and within that week, a precise day, hour, minute, and second, okay, as a target moment, at which case they wouldn't be publicly disclosed, but they would set the price during that period. Now, let me see if I have. Yeah, so how would the price of gold be fixed? Okay, so at that secret moment, no one would know in advance. The price of gold would be fixed at the price that prevails on the commodities exchange of the New York exchange precisely at the target moment, okay? And so the Fed would have to maintain the price of gold within a target range of plus or minus 2%, okay, from that point onward. And it would do this by, not by buying and selling gold, but by doing what it does today, buying and selling government bonds. Okay, so it would not be able to use indirect methods. It couldn't target the federal funds rate to carry out the bill's mandate. It would have to buy and sell bonds, which means that how it would operate the following way. There would be no gold that would be directly involved in the dollar bill standard. The only reference to gold is to fix the price of gold. So let's say it's $1,300. Well, I'll give you an example in a moment. But the dollar would continue, therefore, as a pure fiat money. It would be inconvertible into gold. You and I would not be able to convert dollars into gold. The monetary base, the basic money produced by the Fed, would continue to be fiat dollars. Okay, that would be the Federal Reserve notes that you and I hold, and that that the banks have in their ATM machines, plus the reserves that they have at the Federal Reserve. So the monetary base, which is the raw material of the money supply, would be completely under control of the Fed still. Okay. And the Fed will continue to control the monetary base by buying or selling bonds. Okay. Now let me explain very briefly how that would work. Suppose that the target price set at that target moment, okay, that is at the price on the market that was fixed at that moment, was $1,300 per ounce. So then the Fed would be forced to conduct open market operations. Okay, they would have to sell bonds and suck money out of the system whenever the price of gold rose to $1,326, which is 2% above the target price of $1,300. So by selling bonds, they'd be sucking bank reserves out of the system and reducing the money supply to push down the gold price, okay, within the target range. On the other hand, if the price of gold fell below to the lower limit of $1,274 per ounce, which is, again, at the lower limit of the target range, 2% below 1300, the Fed would have to then buy bonds by creating reserves out of thin air and buying the bonds from the banks. The bank would then loan out more money that would expand the money supply, push the price of gold back up towards $1,300. That's how the system would work. Its supporters call it the goldless gold standard. And they're very happy about that. They say that the dollar bill standard is a gold standard in name only, okay? And they describe it as a goldless gold standard. So there would be no gold coins that would be minted or in circulation. The Fed would not be required to maintain any reserve, nor they have to convert gold into dollars for any official institution or for a U.S. citizen. And so this Dollar Bill Act with Representative Poe would leave the fiat money controlled by the Fed. It would be fully intact, okay? And the supply of dollars would be subject to absolute control by the Fed, okay? So this is really no different than what we have today, okay? Today we tell the central bank that you have to target not the gold price, you have to target inflation. So Janet Yellen talks about keeping inflation or keeping prices rising at a rate of 2% per year. Okay, the monetarists would like to have the money supply rising at 2% per year, so they're targeting the money supply. Well, these goldless gold standard people want to target the gold price. They want to fix the gold price, but that doesn't mean that increasing the money supply to keep the gold price up will keep prices stable by any means. Okay, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But the supporters of this bill, they tend to be supply-siders, okay? They're led by Steve Forbes, a very famous billionaire and the owner of Forbes, an economic journalist named Lewis Woodhill, and an author named Nathan Lewis, okay? And they clearly understand that this is not a real gold standard, that it's a fiat currency subject to monopoly control by the Fed, okay? And they claim that that's the major virtue of this dollar bill standard. And they say, well, that's okay, though, because all gold standards, all money monetary systems are inventions of the government. So Steve Forbes talks about the countless varieties of gold standards, and he describes what he calls a common characteristic of the real gold standard, the following terms. He says, theoretically, you don't need an ounce of the yellow metal to operate a gold standard. All you need is to refer to the price in the open market. That is, target the price of gold. So he doesn't really want a real gold standard. Nor do these other people, and I have some quotes from Nathan Lewis, He says that 100% gold standard is no better than his, what he calls, no gold gold standard, in which the money manager does not buy or sell gold at the parity price, the fixed price, but targets the price of gold by buying or selling bonds, even fine art. Okay, so he says that. And he also says all historical, second bullet point, all historical gold standards have been an invention of government policy. A fixed value system with gold as a policy target. So he doesn't believe it's, the gold standard naturally arose on the market as a result of the decisions of people trying to look for a good medium of exchange. And they all claim that gold is not money. What they do want to say about gold is that gold is good because it's the measuring rod, keeps the money value of money stable. Okay. For example, Lewis says, the yellow metal keeps its intrinsic value better than anything on the planet. Okay. And Woodhill says, the fundamental validity of the gold standard rests upon the premise that the real value of gold remains constant over time. But the question is, what is the intrinsic value of gold? What is the real value of gold these people are talking about? There's no such thing, and certainly not in economics, any good, including gold, has a value based on people's subjective values. A thing itself has no value. There is no value in a thing itself. There is no value in this computer monitor that I'm talking to. It's only value to the extent that I place value on it and others place value on it. So when they never explain what the intrinsic value of gold is, the real value of gold. Okay, if you look at the price of gold, it's continuously fluctuating. It doesn't have an intrinsic value. Okay, it fluctuates in terms of other goods and services in the market. Every commodity has a fluctuates in value. So you search their writings, their books and articles in vain to try to figure out what they mean by intrinsic value. So I never give a definition. Ford tries to, but he really doesn't. He says, the virtue of a properly constructed gold standard is that it's both stable and flexible. It's stable in value and flexible in meeting the marketplace natural need for money. So if an economy is growing rapidly, such a gold-based system would allow for rapid expansion of the money supply. So notice what he's saying. He likes this kind of a gold standard because it will allow a rapid increase in the money supply. Okay, and as a result, it will allow inflation. So we sum up, and I went through this pretty quickly. You can look at the slides later. The dollar bill standard is really not a gold standard. It doesn't restrain the Fed from increasing the money supply, and it would certainly collapse just as the Bretton Woods system did. Okay, I'll stop here, and I will take questions. There's a question that says, since Keynes called the gold standard a barbarous relic, why did he agree to the quasi-gold standard at Bretton Woods? That's a very good question. The reason why he agreed to that, and was even in favor of it, was because he didn't think that people would accept what he really wanted was a world money, sort of a global world money that was controlled by the U.S. and Great Britain. He wanted a system in which all central banks could inflate the money supply at the same rate. After World War II, he knew that Great Britain would be unable, would have to rebuild and restore its economy, so it would be printing a lot of money and importing a lot of goods. So Great Britain would have a continual balance of payments deficit unless other countries inflated their money supply at the same rate. And if other countries did that, then all prices would go up together, so Great Britain could inflate and pay for the projects it needed to restore its economy, according to Keynes, without suffering balance of payments deficits. So he wanted to get a system which would guarantee inflation on the part of all countries. He didn't really get what he wanted, okay? The U.S. really didn't want that type of system, okay? So the U.S., put its own currency at the center of the whole thing. It didn't agree to having sort of a quasi-world currency that Keynes wanted. Um, there's a question that says, is there any bill in Congress to eliminate gold holdings from the capital gains tax? I don't know of any. That would be a good step forward to restore real gold standard. That is to get rid of the sales tax and the capital gains tax on gold so that people would be able to hold gold and not have to pay any sort of tax on it if its value went up. They would be more likely to hold more gold and therefore to use gold as the dollar became weaker and less stable. But certainly the sponsors of this bill, that is the dollar bill standard, would, you know, they don't care about the capital gains tax on gold. They don't care about that because they're not interested in using gold as money. In fact, if you look at the slides I went through very quickly, at some point, one of the supporters of this standard said something like, we do not want gold to be used as money. We want gold only to be used as a measure of value, to stabilize the value of the dollar, which is something else, which is paper money. So they don't want a genuine gold standard. There's a question relating to my money pyramid. Under the classical gold standard, it looks like under the classical gold standard, you still have fractional reserve banking. If so, classical gold standard does not sound like a panacea. Yes, you're right. There was fractional reserve banking under the classical gold standard. But I use it as an example because it was a historical example, a historical episode in which money was really gold. Okay, and even if we had central bank, they were constrained by the gold standard. I think if you got rid of central banks and you got rid of any sort of lender of last resort that would bail banks out, even if you had a fractional reserve gold standard, but each bank was responsible for its own gold reserves, I think eventually there would be you would have a few recessions from inflation, a few recessions. But then what you would have happening is that banks learning that fractional reserve banking is not something that let's say maximizes their profits, that they're going to be in continual trouble if they continue to issue unbacked notes and deposits. So even sound banks will be subject to bank runs, because once weaker banks that made bad loans begin to fail, the suspicion will fall on the sounder banks. And as soon as suspicion falls on these sounder banks, people rush to these banks. They're still fractional reserve banks. Even if they've made good loans, much of their money or the deposits have been loaned out and will not be returned for 1 year, 5 years, or 30 years, even if they are good loans. So the bank will be insolvent almost immediately. So I think all banks will begin to learn the lesson of fractional reserve banking as being unstable, and will begin to move towards a system where you don't lend out people's deposits. You may, if you want to lend, you then issue 6 month or 1 year or 2 year or 3 year certificates of deposit where people contractually agree that they cannot withdraw their money for that period of time. You can then make loans for that period of time, and there will be no instability in the system. Banks could also issue 5 and 10 year bonds, or what are called debentures, in which people will loan the money for 5 or 10 years, and they can use that money to lend out. So there would be two parts to a bank. One part would be strictly for warehousing of people's money. Let's say you go back to gold, people's gold. So it would tend to hold 100% reserve. The other would be the savings part of the bank, where people's savings were put into the bank by purchasing certificates of deposit or longer-term bonds, and people would refrain from taking their money out by contract, and the banks could then use that money to lend out without fearing bankrupt. Okay. So I think that's, you know, a system that would work to stabilize the economy and get rid of recessions. I don't think you can go right back to that system. There's a book by Lewis Lehrman that would keep the Federal Reserve intact, but would go back to a fractional reserve replacement gold standard. That came out last year also, okay, in addition to the book by Nathan Lewis. Perhaps what I'll do is I'll put up some of the literature that I cited in this slideshow. I'll put up some of the things that you should read if you're interested in following this topic up. I have a little bit of trouble. I can, let's see, my connection was lost here. Hold on, I'll get it back. There's a question here, which I really don't know the answer to. Is the dollar collapse inevitable? Well, I think continued depreciation of the dollar is inevitable, and whether it's going to collapse in one huge cataclysm, where it's certainly a possibility that the Chinese and others that hold huge reserves of dollars could lose trust in the dollar, okay, and could begin to sell dollars on world markets, driving its value down, causing others who are holding dollars to get rid of dollars and reinforcing that process of driving the value of the dollar down. Once that happens, interest rates will skyrocket in the U.S. And people will begin to spend their dollars in the U.S. and prices will begin to rise at a rapid rate. So you could have a downward spiral of the value of the dollar. Now, it depends on what the Fed does. Okay, the Fed seems to be winding down its so-called quantitative easing program, but it may not be doing so fast enough. Money supply is still increasing, while the probability is there, I don't believe that it's something that's going to imminently occur, that it's a collapse in the dollar. I think before we get a collapse in the dollar, I think the government will need to fear even more, and in a way it's worse, and try to put price controls on, wager price controls on the American economy. That is, if suddenly people lost trust in the dollar, began to spend it, so that prices were rapidly rising. I think rather than stop the increase in the money supply and risk of a big recession, they would instead try to put wage and price controls on the American economy, which would really nationalize a large part of it. So that's something I think might happen. But I'm no predictor on these things. Okay. I think that exhausts the questions that were asked. And I thank you for participating. And next week we will have Mark Thornton giving his lecture. So have a good evening. Thank you.